Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today's show, we're going to continue our format, which has been to do a round robin here of events of the past week, of which several have been quite interesting. And then in the second part of the show, we will continue the overview of my recent book here, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, which, by the way, you can purchase either on my website, which is Kyklos Productions, KYKLOSProductions.com, or through my blog, JackRasmus.com, or through the publisher. Anyway, you can go to the website or blog, and there's an icon of the book photo jacket, and just click on that and go from there. You can purchase through PayPal, or then you could just email me at drjackrasmus, all one string, at Gmail. Okay, in any event, let's begin with that. We will cover in the second half of the show our continuation of the review of that, and we will focus on the chapters in the book dealing with central banks and government debt. Okay, but let's turn back and talk about the general review of the last week here. Well, at the top, I just have to talk about front page news here in the business press about this fellow Shkreli. Remember Shkreli, Turing Pharmaceuticals? We had a show on him not too long ago, and on the pharma, big pharma, ripping everybody off. And the point about the pharmaceutical drug price gouging going on, still going on. Congress is dithering there, talking about it in election year. They'll just talk. They're not going to do anything because they want money from these guys. Pharma's a big, pharma industry's a big contributor to campaign contributions here. And I think the second biggest lobbying industry expenditures. You know, it's plugged into, the pharma companies are plugged into, deeply into the political structure here. And Congress isn't going to jeopardize that when they want the money to flow for their elections here. You know, one of the worst conditions in the U.S. Economy, political economy, is this money connection. It's so totally corrupted. You know, what limited democracy we have in this country, that it almost is non-existent anymore. Money for lobbying, money for campaigns and so forth, and nothing's really going to change until that money is at least reduced from the system. But that doesn't look like it's imminent here in any way. You know, there's 30,000 registered lobbyists in Washington, registered. Who knows about those who aren't, right? 30,000 of them running around, and they're virtually all corporations. Lots of money there, and lots of largesse, and Congress, of course, just takes it all and says, oh, you know, we don't have anything to do with buying our votes. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. In any event, this guy Shkreli, if you remember, Turing Pharmaceuticals, a hedge fund guy. You know, a sleazy hedge fund guy. And that's one of the problems with pharma and price manipulation going on. The hedge fund and Wall Street have, shadow banks have got their claws into the pharma companies and are running them or influencing their decisions and so forth. And what do hedge funds and Wall Street do? They manipulate prices, security prices, right? That's fraud. It's the whole game. That's what banking and particularly shadow banking is all about. How to fraudulently manipulate prices. Well, you know, that's exactly what's going on in pharma, a little different than derivatives and so forth, but essentially the same thing. They buy up a small company that has a drug, you know, that had been charging reasonable rates for it. They buy up that company. They take all the stuff off the market. They want to make sure that there is no generics possible to compete with them on price. And then they jack the price up by hundreds and thousands of percent. And by the way, there's a tie-in here, as we've talked about recently, with the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, because one of the provisions of that protects them, the pharma companies, for 8 to 11 years. They already have that protection in the U.S., 8 to 11 years, to continue price gouging when they come up with a drug, or, as I say, when they buy a company with a drug and jack the price up. And now the TPP has that same provision as in it. That was one of the number one negotiating demands of U.S. Negotiators in the TPP. Recent round of negotiations. So these guys are covered. These pharma companies are covered both domestically and globally now. So anyway, this guy Shkreli, Martin Shkreli here, ex-hedge fund manipulator, sort of brought all this price gouging to the public attention here recently, by raising the price of a drug that was costing, maybe $12.50 or something like that a pill to thousands of dollars a pill. That price gouging became, people became aware, and now they're aware of these other companies, Pfizer and Valeant and so forth, all doing the same. Anyway, this guy Shkreli has recently gotten arrested. Yeah, they finally arrested the scumbag and for running a Ponzi scheme. Yeah, interesting, isn't it? It really brings to light, the nature of all this. By the way, this drug that he had jacked up to 5,000% increase in price was critical. It was a life-saving drug, right, for women who got infections during pregnancy or folks with AIDS, AIDS sufferers and cancer and so forth, right? This guy Shkreli was manipulating stock, right, for this company, Retrofin, a drug maker he founded before he bought this other company and this other drug that we're talking about here, right? They followed his trail, and they found out a lot of shaky stuff going on with this guy at Turing Pharmaceuticals. That's the company he has, and the drug that he had was called Daraprim, which, by the way, he raised to $750 a pill. Previously, it was $13.50 a pill, right? This guy has been, they caught up with this guy and charged him with running a Ponzi scheme in his companies here. Just goes to show you what's going on with this pharmaceutical industry. It's a real crime. And, all of these CEOs in these price gouging pharma companies, ought to be in jail. Anyway, that's one interesting news. Another piece of interesting news is what's happening in South America economically. There's a neoliberal wave sweeping in South America, and we see that in the three big countries down there that sort of challenged Yankee capitalists here and global capital and went their own ways, and now they're being brought to heel. And the U.S. And big corporations have been clearly funding some of the opposition to the existing social democratic governments. I'm talking about the Kirchner government in Argentina, which recently just lost an election here. And the right-wing business guy has taken over, a guy named Macri. What's going on in Brazil right now with the Workers' Party, Dilma Rousseff, being deposed here and now being impeached after the fact. They're trying to clean out that party using the issue of the big oil company, their Petrobras, criminal activity, fraud, and stealing money from the oil company, and so forth, as a basis for going after the government. By the way, they used the legal means for going after the Kirchner government about a year ago as well. And now we got the same thing going on in Venezuela. Recently, the opposition was able to capture parliament, majority in parliament, not the presidency, but parliament. And now the U.S. is going after leading pro-Venezuela administration figures, even in the army and in the government and in the ruling group there, going after them as drug dealers, claiming that the whole Maduro government is really a cover for the South American drug trade, which is just absurd. But anyway, you know, the U.S. is leading the charge against the Venezuela government, and I'm sure there's a connection there in Brazil and Argentina that will never really fully reveal for a while. But the attack has been on the big governments in South America that were social democratic, liberal in any sense of that word, and we're beginning to see the consequences of this. The South American Argentina government, run by a big businessman now, Macri, M-A-C-R-I, his name is, has come out, and wow, he's not wasting any time. They're introducing neoliberal policies with a vengeance down there. They just arbitrarily devalued the Argentine peso by 40%. 40%. Wow, that's going to have a big impact. What's the impact? Well, the impact will be a sharp double-digit increase in inflation, because a lot of the consumer goods are imported into Argentina, and when you devalue the currency, you raise the price of import goods, and therefore inflation, consumer inflation, right? And that's really, really going to happen now, big time, right? And lots of layoffs, and already it's going to be a big crisis, a big political unrest coming in Argentina, just as coming now in Venezuela and Brazil. So watch what's going on in South America here, both politically and economically. It's neoliberalism attempting to reestablish a firm foothold that it had in the past before the U.S. Got diverted to the Middle East and sort of turned a shoulder to events in South America, allowing these countries to drift to the left. Now, clearly, there's the you know, the shadow of American capitalism reestablishing control in South America, and doing it in consort with indigenous ruling or capitalist groups and parties and so forth, while putting pressure on South America and these governments economically. You know, the good example is Venezuela. Venezuela has had runaway inflation. And that's because the U.S., with the help of certain corporations, have been squeezing Venezuela by not providing, making sure it doesn't have enough dollars. Because a lot of these goods, you see, you have to buy with dollars in the world for imports and so forth. If you want to buy things from the rest of the world, you know, they don't want. The rest of the world does not want to accept a non-trading currency like the Venezuelan bolivar, right? They want dollars. If you want to buy something from Italy, you got to use dollars or euros or whatever. You can't use your own currency. It's not a trading currency. So they got to have dollars. So the U.S. has been squeezing these countries by, in various ways, reducing the availability of dollars to them. That's one big reason why there's been so much inflation in Venezuela, and of course the whole idea is to you know, cause economic disruption before you plan a legal coup or an illegal coup if the legal one doesn't work. Well, there's a legal one underway in Venezuela right now, and the opposition has been able to capture part of the government there. as a result of all the economic problems and dislocations in that government, in that country. So we'll be watching what's going on in South America quite closely here in coming weeks. Another big piece of news here is what's going on with the U.S. Congress. Right, U.S. Congress finally passed a bill here, a budget bill, over $1 trillion in tax cuts and other spending projects. This is the first time in about 8 years, you know, that there hasn't been a really sharp, contested boycott by the Republicans of any budget in the U.S. You know, now that they've got control of Congress, oh, now they cooperate, right? You know, their whole strategy for 7 years was we don't agree to anything the Democrats or Obama and others are proposing, and we hold a united front here, and we all boycott. No, 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 no. And that's been the story for 7 years. Well, now they're in Congress, having won control of the Senate last November. Not last November, the November before, 2014, they got full control. And, you know, what they're doing is, we'll concede a little bit to the Democrats as long as we run the show. And that's what they're doing. And here's this big budget, $1.1 trillion. And you know what? Most of it's tax cuts for, guess who, corporations and the rich. Yeah, another $650 billion in tax cuts. Most of which, again, investors and corporations. Now, put this in context. You know, $650 billion over the next decade. That's an additional to the $4 trillion in tax cuts over the next decade that was passed in 2013. That was part of that so-called fiscal cliff solution. Right? $4 trillion then over, you know, the decade the following, 2013, another $650 billion now. So that's $4.65 trillion. $4.65 trillion. Now that's on top of $450 billion in 2010 to 12 that was agreed to by Obama, extending the previous Bush, George W. Bush, tax cuts. So $4 trillion in 2013, $650 billion now, another $450 billion in 2010-12, right? So that's over $5 trillion since 2010 in tax cuts, most of which are, 80% of which at least, are corporate investor tax cuts. Okay, 80% of $5 trillion is $4 trillion passed since 2010 in tax cuts for corporations and the rich. Before that, another $3.4 trillion under Bush, 80% of which were corporate and investor tax cuts. So we're looking at a minimum of $7 trillion, or more than $7 trillion in tax cuts for corporations and the rich and investors. $7 trillion. Well, no wonder we're running a deficit. You know, that's the number one cause of the budget deficit. Add on top of that, trillions of dollars thrown into that toilet called the Middle East and wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and just about everywhere else, right? Libya and Syria and Yemen, all these places. You know, the U.S. is totally destabilizing the whole Middle East, keeping it roiling. That way they keep everybody over there fighting against each other, and that's how they rule. That's how the British ruled the area for a long time, and that's how the U.S. is doing it. Okay, so you throw a couple more, $3-4 trillion of the cost of all that, which is continuing, you know, on top of the $7 trillion in tax cuts for the rich investors and their corporations, you know, that's $10 trillion. $10 trillion have been wasted in the last 15 years. You know, well, no wonder we have deficits. Come on, you know. On top of that, you know, you have costs of bailing out the economy and the unemployed tokenly a little bit, you know, when there's crises and recessions. On top of that, you have very slow growth, which reduces tax revenues, right? Then you throw in stuff like Part D prescription drugs in 2005 under Bush, which is really a big subsidy for pharma companies. And then you do Obamacare, ACA, in 2010-14, right, which is another almost $1 trillion, most of which goes to health insurance companies. Mm-hmm. And that adds to the deficit as well, because there's not adequate tax revenue. There's no tax revenues for Part D pharma bills. That's $50 billion a year. That all comes out of the general treasury, right? $50 billion a year for 10 years now. You know, that's been $500 billion to the pharma companies for Part D. Yeah, there's some benefits for seniors there, some trickle-down going on, but, you know, most of it, allows these pharma companies. In fact, under that Part D bill passed in 2005, pharma companies get to charge whatever price they want, and you can't challenge them, you see? So that really tells you what this bill was really all about. It's a big, it's a big free money bag for the pharma companies economically. And the same thing with the ACA. There's not enough money raised for the ACA, Obamacare here, but the big insurance companies are getting everything they want. And by the way, now they're jacking up prices again. Yeah, prices are going through the roof for pharmaceutical drugs under the ACA, and for general health insurance costs under the ACA. And by the way, you got to watch out. You know, they say you read in the press, health spending costs are going down. There's a difference between health prices and health costs. Health spending costs means people are just not spending as much, because the prices are becoming unsustainable. People can't afford these prices, can't afford to pay, so they self-impose, self-rationalize healthcare access, right? They control the costs by not using the healthcare, right? And that's the case with Obamacare. If you look at some of the prices, people are signing up to Obamacare, but what are they signing up for? I'll tell you. They're signing up for huge deductible plans, thousands of dollars of deductible. It's just catastrophic emergency health care. That's all it is. And they're paying, significant amounts for that, and they're not using it. So the health insurance companies, are getting paid insurance premiums for insurances that people aren't using except in catastrophes. That's the whole scheme here, you see. But even Obamacare, what little financial base there is for funding it is being picked apart by the Republicans, you see. And a lot of the ways in which the Obamacare was supposed to be funded, which was medical device taxes, right, and Cadillac's tax on Cadillac high-end health insurance plans and so forth, all that stuff has been put aside, and a lot of exemptions for a lot of businesses. So Obamacare is going to collapse, as I said it would, after the next election, because there isn't sufficient funding for it, you see. And Republicans have this very clever strategy of they're going to chip away at the funding base of this thing so that it can't be paid for, and that will enable them then to totally revamp the whole thing. Now, that's coming in 2017, I predict. That was a big piece of information here, the U.S. Congressional budget. More tax cuts. Add to that $7 trillion here. Going forward, increase the deficit even more, undermine the funding for the Obamacare as a prelude to giving it the axe. You see, it's no different than what they do with Venezuela, right? If you want to kill something economically, you deprive it of funding. Or you cause economic disruption and dislocation. You sort of set the ground for the coup de grace, right? They're setting the ground for the coup de grace for Obamacare here, and they've already set the ground for a coup de grace in Venezuela by disrupting that whole economy. Of course, the collapse of oil prices has something to do with Venezuela's economic collapse as well. you know, Venezuela very dependent on oil exports. And while oil was $120 a barrel in 2014, they could, you know, still fund, you know, the economy. And even though you had inflation because of the squeeze on the currency by the U.S. and corporations, you know, they still had enough oil revenue they could offset that and keep the populace tamed as far as, you know, protests and so forth were concerned. But now with the collapse of oil to, by the way, around $35 a barrel globally and going lower, they were deprived, the Venezuela government, just like other governments, of this very important source of social revenue. So they had to print money. And, of course, that leads to inflation as well as the collapse of their currency, leading to inflation from imports in those countries. Okay, so I don't want to go back to that. We will cover that probably in the next show, what's really going on continuing down there in South America. But for now, you know, we got another notch on the strategy here of giving more tax cuts in the U.S. and Congress in an election year. And then the other thing that's big news here is the Fed rate hike, of course. Big news, Fed rate hike. Yeah. What does it all mean? You know, the Federal Reserve here a couple days ago raised, for the first time in 9 years, began to raise interest rates. A quarter of a percent, right? It was, the interest rates were at 0.25, one quarter, 1%. They raised it to 0.5 by one quarter. These are short-term rates, by the way. The Federal Reserve, the central bank of the U.S., is able to raise short-term rates, but not long-term rates. It has very little influence over long-term, except perhaps to some extent through raising short-term may have a lag effect that will then raise long-term rates. Well, long-term rates have already been rising in the U.S. for some time here. And that, of course, has to do with the increase in the value of the U.S. dollar, which has been rising as well. Now, that latter increase, the dollar increase, is to some extent driven by a drift in the short-term rates, but also is driven by other major currencies lowering or devaluing the value of their currency. And we've seen this massive devaluation going on by Europe and Japan. Right? They've been reducing the value of their currencies, which raises the value of the U.S. dollar. That's because they've been injecting their central banks, the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan, have been injecting trillions of dollars in terms of their own QE, quantitative easing programs. You see, that's where a central bank goes out and actually prints money electronically and buys up assets, buys up bonds and other assets. In Japan, they're buying everything, you know, stocks and so forth, out of desperation. Buys up these assets, and in buying these assets from private investors and private banks, puts money into the economy. Takes the assets out and puts money in. Now, usually the central bank buys up the assets that are toxic. In other words, have collapsed in value. So they're really subsidizing these investors who invested, and then the assets they bought collapsed in value. And here comes the central bank. Okay, we'll buy it at an above market price here. We're subsidizing you. We're giving you. We're saving your bad investment. You know, that's like saying if you bought a house and, you know, its value collapsed, the government would say, well, we'll buy it from you at the original price you bought it, right? Or the same thing with an automobile, right? Of course, they don't do that for consumers. They only do that for investors and bankers. So the central bank goes in and buys up this money, these bad assets, rather, with plenty of money. That's called QE. Well, when you pump all that money into the economy, you got excess supply of money, and it has the effect of reducing the value of your currency in global markets. Well, if you reduce the value of your currency in global markets, right, it makes your products that you're trying to export more competitive. So it's an indirect way of trying to boost your domestic economy by devaluing your currency, done through QE injections. You can also do that through maintaining zero interest rates, which the U.S. did for 9 years, right? Or 7 years, zero rates. 9 years, they've been reducing the rates. So that zero interest rate policy is called ZIRP, Z-I-R-P, for zero bound rates, plus QE is the other way of injecting huge amounts of money into the economy and directly buying. You see, zero interest rates means any private bank wants to come to the Fed can borrow money from the Fed for free, essentially, and then go loan it out, to other companies, loan it out to other banks, loan it out to speculators, speculate itself in stocks and bonds and so forth, right? Doesn't cost them any money. It's free money, and they go and spend it, and they make money on free money. You see, that's what it's all about. That's what zero rates are about. Subsidize the banks and subsidize investors. That's the whole strategy with QE, and it's been the whole strategy with central banks led by the Federal Reserve globally. You see, there's a consortium of national central banks, and the Fed's in the driver's seat. There's the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, Bank of Canada, and so forth. They're all together. They watch and follow each other to some extent. And the Fed is, the more equal among the equals in the whole thing. The policy of all of them has been, we're going to try to get recovery from the 2008-09 crash by pumping money into the banks. Right, we're going to bail out the banks. We're going to bail them out with free money. Here, take free money, fill up the black hole of your losses, right? And secondly, we will buy up the bad assets, not just from you bankers, but from all you individual investors. We'll buy up everything you took a loss on. That's QE. That's zero interest rates. That's been the primary strategy of capitalists since 2008-09. They're not going to, and they decided we're not going to stimulate with fiscal policy. We're not going to increase government spending significantly in order to boost the economy. Right? And we're not going to give big tax cuts to average consumers to stimulate the economy. That's fiscal policy. We're not going to do that, right? Because by doing that, they say, you're bailing out Joe Main Street first, and if Joe Main Street gets bailed out, maybe he'll buy more of our products. And we, the bankers and corporations, will get bailed out second and third, right? You bail out the households and consumers first, and then we follow. That's what fiscal policy does. And capitalists have decided, they don't like that. That's indirect bailout of them. They want to get the money up front. That's what monetary policy does. Give them the money up front. The bank, here's the money. Give me your bad bonds, right? Or your bad stock, whatever. In Japan, they're buying everything. That bails them out first, and then maybe it trickles down to the consumer and the worker, you see. That's the difference between fiscal policy and monetary policy. Monetary policy bails out the bankers and investors first, and maybe it trickles down, and very little have trickled down, whereas fiscal policy bails out the consumers and workers first, and hopefully they'll spend, and that will boost profits in the longer run. That's why you see everywhere across the advanced economies a refusal to engage in fiscal policy, fiscal spending. In some places, it's more severe than others. Like in Europe, it's austerity, when they actually cut the spending in order to prevent the deficits from getting too large and the debt getting too large, because the recovery is very slow when you do it in monetary means. Instead of fiscal policy that's sort of neutral, the fiscal policy becomes austerity. That's Japan, that's Europe, and so forth, right? In the U.S., initially, Obama threw in a little fiscal stimulus here, most of which is tax cuts. But anyway, a little bit of fiscal stimulus in 2009-10, but then they took it all back. It was like $800 billion initial Obama stimulus in 2009. Well, in 2011, they took $1 trillion back. The Republicans boycotted and brought the economy, the government to a halt, and the Democrats collapsed and conceded. with $1 trillion in deficit cuts. So we turned to austerity in 2011 in the U.S. Now, part of that austerity, $1.1 trillion, and another $1 trillion scheduled after that, was supposed to be defense spending cuts. But that's what the fiscal cliff in 2013 negotiations were all about. In other words, they then retroactively exempted defense spending cuts and just kept the social program cuts. So what we ended up with was about a $1.5 trillion austerity in 2011-2013 combined. In other words, Congress took back twice what the initial Obama stimulus in 2009 provided. So the U.S. has been in a moderate fiscal austerity strategy since 2011. But the Europeans have been even more fiscally austere, you might say. And, you know, that's why a lot of those countries, Europe's in even worse shape than the U.S. Europe growth is, fluctuates between a 1% growth and a negative 1% growth. They're bouncing along stagnant, right? By the way, I have a chapter in my book called Europe's Chronic Stagnation. And there's another chapter called Japan's Perpetual Recession, because Japan's even worse than Europe, you see. Japan is in and out of recession here since 2008. In fact, having had five recessions. Oh, by the way, just as parenthetically here, Japan, their fifth recession, you know, they had two consecutive quarters of negative GDP here in the second, third quarter. It's interesting how immediately after the second quarter negative GDP was announced, within a week, Japan said, oh, our numbers were wrong. We really grew in the third quarter. They revised it within a week. They went from a negative 0.8% GDP drop, significant in the third quarter, to a 1.1% positive GDP. They said, we found some data that we overlooked initially. Well, that's nonsense, because there's no way you can revise GDP numbers within a week. You know, the whole idea with revisions in GDP is to wait for other data to come in, and that usually takes several weeks. In the U.S., we have a second and third revision, but that's like 60 days after the initial preliminary GDP announcement. And then we have another weeks and months delay after that for the third final revision. But Japan revised it within a week and said, and they revised it almost 2%. Come on. You know, they're lying everywhere about GDP numbers increasingly because they can't get the growth up anywhere. It's a joke in India. They doubled their GDP numbers overnight, and we got Nigeria, we got Europe, you know, playing games. Some of the countries there with, you know, counting drug dealers and prostitutes now in their GDP numbers. And the U.S. revised $500 billion by redefining intellectual property here in 2013. You've got to take $500 billion out of U.S. GDP numbers every time they announce it, which is about 0.3%. So the U.S. economy is still growing less than 2% for some time now. Okay, so, understand what's going on here, not just with GDP numbers, but with this whole monetary injection strategy. The big picture is this is the preferred way that global capitalists, including especially the U.S. leading the way, have been trying to get the economy going again. And yes, they bailed out the banks years ago, but they still continued the free money, you see. The banks were bailed out, 2011. By 2011, corporate profits, went way back up in 2010-11, and over the last 5 years, corporate profits have tripled. Right? The S&P stock index of major corporations has tripled. Corporations have not only increased their profits and their stock values 300%, right, but with the zero rates, virtual zero rates, they've gone into the bond markets and they've raised free money in the bond markets almost. The corporations themselves are doing free money. There's kind of a reverse private QE going on on the corporate private sector side in this form of issuing free, you know, almost virtual free cost corporate bonds. And they've risen, and they've raised $5 trillion since 2010 in corporate bonds. $5 trillion, trillions more in profits, trillions more in stock appreciation, you know. $10 trillion just in the U.S. alone in 5 years. You know, that's why they could turn around and get $5 trillion back to their shareholders in dividends and stock buybacks. And then they're sitting on trillions more, right? This is how the economy, particularly in the U.S., has gotten so screwed up. I mean, it is absolutely crazy now. There's nothing fundamental about it. Fundamental meaning producing goods and hiring people and, you know, providing consumption and income to buy the goods. You know, that whole model is totally broken down. And you see, you know, attempt to keep the patient, the chronically ill capitalist economy patient, on life support. And that life support is free money. That's what's going on. Free money life support. And they bailed out the banks 5 years ago, and they've continued zero interest rates. They've continued QE in various forms in different places. Right? Why? Because it's a golden goose, you know, and politically, you know, the financial interest and everybody else with big money, investors and so forth, don't want that stopped. Okay, so why did they raise interest rates a little bit here? Well, that's because, you know, they want more free money. Well, how do you get free money by raising interest rates? Well, by raising interest rates, all the free money that had flowed out of the country into emerging markets in China now comes back. You know, the higher interest rates here and the collapsing economies and emerging markets, all the investors who had plowed part of this free money from the Fed and the Bank of England and so forth in previous years, a good part of that flowed out into emerging markets, you see. Another part of that multi-trillion dollar Fed central bank injections since 2008-9, another part of that, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars flowed into financial assets. Part of it flowed into, let's give the money back in stock buybacks and in dividend payouts to our shareholders, you know, who then invested in financial markets or offshore. You see, the Fed has injected almost $4 trillion in QE, maybe another $5 to $10 trillion in zero interest rates into the banking system and the economy. So the Fed has injected since 2008-9 $10 trillion plus. But then Bank of England, you know, $600 billion in QE and near zero interest rates as well. You got to add that amount to it. And then the European Central Bank recently, you know, $1 trillion in QE, but before that other QE-like programs called long-term refinance options 1 and 2. So, you know, they had pumped about 3, 4 trillion in euros into their banks and the economy. By the way, the banks in Europe are still sitting on $1.5 trillion of non-performing loans. So that hasn't changed much over there. And then Japan, you know, introduced its QE, $1.7 trillion as well, and zero rates for years now going on. So you add up all the central bank monetary injections since 2008, I estimate in my book, in chapter 14 on central banks and debt, I estimate about $25 trillion conservatively has been injected into the global economy. $25 trillion by all these central banks, led by the U.S. Central Bank, right, to bail out the banks and investors, and then continuing to bail them out. Well, they were bailed out years ago, but the flow has continued. Now, a lot of that, where did that $25 trillion go? As I just said a minute ago, part of it goes into financial speculation. Trillions of it goes in buybacks and dividends. They're sitting on still a residual of trillions, these banks and corporations. Right? But trillions went into emerging markets, China and emerging markets. Well, They've since, the central banks are backing off of QE, at least in the U.S. and U.K. The other, Japan and Europe, are lagging. They're still doing their QE. Johnny-come-lately stood the whole show, QE. But the zero rates have been there for quite some time, everywhere. Instead of having more QE, the U.S. Central bankers have decided, the British, let's just have some of this money come back from emerging markets. That way we don't have to create more QE, because it's becoming politically and socially too obvious what QE and the central banks are doing. You know, even the right-wing populists in the U.S., Tea Partiers and others, are saying, well, yeah, what's the central bank doing, all this free money to the big corporations? See, Tea Party, their base is, you know, small business base. And small business gets screwed by big business just as much as consumers do sometimes. So the point is, let's raise interest rates, because we can't continue this. It's too obvious. And raising interest rates causes the money to flow back, that had flowed into emerging markets, flow back to the U.S. It becomes free money, you see, once again. And that's why interest rates long-term have been rising for some time, and now short-term are rising. And the money is flowing out of emerging markets. Over $500 billion this year flowed net out of emerging markets back to the U.S. and U.K. and advanced economies, right? $500 billion. And that includes money flowing out of China. Right. We've had a capital outflow of China, and that has contributed to the slowing of the Chinese economy, which, by the way, is not growing at 6.9. It's barely growing, I would say, at 4.5%. Barely. It's not bad, but still, it's not 6.9 official percent GDP growth rate over there. What's happening in China emerging markets is they're trying to offset this and boost their economies again. China's central bank is attempting to do that, the PBOC, People's Bank of China, and central banks, you know, throughout emerging market economies are trying to attract the money back. Well, how do you attract the money back? You raise your domestic interest rates. You know, you follow the path of Uncle Sam and the central bank, the Fed, raising rates. You raise rates too. Well, but raising your own domestic rates slows your own economy down. And raising rates in the U.S. will slow the economy down in the U.S. That U.S. economy is nowhere near as healthy as the media spin says, right? For example, we already have manufacturing contracting here because exports are falling in the U.S., export sales, because the value of the dollar has been rising. How much has it risen? Almost 20% against the basket of goods, a basket of other currencies. On average, then, about 20% it's risen. Against the Japanese, you know, more than 20%. Against the yen and against the euro, about the same. So who have been the big currency manipulators? Well, Europe and Japan, but you don't hear that in the press, do you? You hear, oh, China is a big currency manipulator. No, China's pegged its currency to the dollar, and it's fluctuated only within a range of 3-4%. By the way, it's interesting to note here that last week, or week before, I think, China struck a deal with the IMF to include its currency, the yuan, as a global trading reserve currency. Now, that means that China can no longer peg its currency to the dollar, as it has for years now. So it will float, which means that it will devalue. And the Chinese know this, and they're doing this in order to offset the extreme currency devaluation moves by the Japanese, stealing a lot of their business there in Asia, right, and Europe as well. Right, so China is devaluing. Well, Europe is devaluing, right, through QE, trying to drive its currency down. In fact, the euro is almost at parity now with the dollar. It was $1.45 euro for euro to the dollar, 1.45. Now it's like 1.1, and it's going to parity. I predicted that years ago it would go to parity. So that big devaluation, you know, 20-30% over there. Actually, about 30%. And, you know, Japan's currency is devalued against the dollar at least 30%, and against the Chinese yuan by about 50%. So China's devaluating. It's going off of the peg, and it, you know, becomes a global currency, which means it will float lower. And, you know, but when it floats lower, the price of imports rise. That means China buys less commodities than oil, which causes global oil and commodity prices to collapse. And that leaves the other emerging markets, you know, like Brazil and Argentina, Indonesia, and places like that. Well, they're behind the eight ball. They're behind the eight ball for several reasons. One, it's forcing them to devalue their currency, which raises import inflation, right, and doesn't really succeed in keeping the capital from flowing back to the U.S. and U.K. and places like that. That's still going to happen, but it causes their domestic economies to come to a halt, which is happening, and results in political unrest. So rising inflation because their currency is falling, capital flight, less investment, less growth, you know, their economies decline domestically as their inflation rises domestically. That's called stagflation, where you have rising unemployment and rising inflation. That's stagflation. That's occurring in all of these countries, like in Latin America and so forth. And, of course, it results in political unrest. Average folks don't understand who's behind the crisis in their economies, and they blame the existing social democratic governments, and they don't come out and vote. The right wing takes over, like Macri in Argentina, you know, and the right wingers in Venezuela, and those that are trying to depose the Workers' Party and Rousseff in Brazil and so forth, right? People get confused. They don't support their governments because they say, oh, that's the government and this is my problem. But they don't know and understand where the problem comes from. It comes from these policies in the advanced economies. Right? It comes from the central banks. And who determine what the central banks do? The bankers, the private bankers and investors. Right? Just like the pharmaceutical companies. They got a stranglehold on government and on representatives. They get whatever they want. So this is the origins of this social unrest going on now in Latin America and elsewhere. Economics is behind all of this, eventually. See? Back to the U.S. economy here, this rate increase, right, comes at a time when the U.S. economy is pretty darn weak, if you look at it, right? As I said, manufacturing and exports are negative, right? Construction activity is only still two-thirds of what it was. Interest rates going up are going to slow retail sales, home sales. Right? Probably won't slow apartment building and apartment sales because people got to live somewhere, and that's most of what's happening in the housing sector, and that's a business investment decision, not a consumer homeowner decision to buy a single family home. Right? But the point is, the higher interest rates will drive up the dollar, that will slow exports and manufacturing even more. They're already negative. The higher interest rates will certainly won't do anything positive for the construction housing sector. At the same time, we have the end of the gas, oil, fracking industrial boom of 2012-14 here in the U.S., right? And that has to do with collapsing world oil prices as the global economy slows and politics driven by the Saudis. Of course, we have even more gas, oil, more oil coming on the global market. The global oil price is $35 a barrel, and we have more supply coming on. Iran is now pumping more oil, right? And now we have this Congress just passed this export bill, which allows the U.S. To export oil and gas after 40 years preventing exports, right, which is a response to the collapse of the gas oil fracking industry here. In their fight with the Saudis, keep that going. But that's going to cause an increase in the global availability of oil, i.e. the oil supply. Right? So we got increasing supply everywhere of oil, which is interesting because, you know, just a decade ago, everyone would say, peak oil, there's no supply of oil. nonsense. The world's awash with oil, and oil reserves are huge still. And we see this pretty much now. That whole peak oil thing was an ideological ploy by the oil industry, I believe. Anyway, the gas oil fracking industrial boom is over. We got hundreds of thousands being laid off in the fracking fields in the Midwest, Texas, and elsewhere, right? So that's ending. That's going to be a source of weakness, right? We've got median wages for non-management, non-professional families still below what they were in 2007. Retail sales are slowing. Where's the growth? Where's the growth rate here? I don't see any indication. Yeah, we're creating jobs, but they're low-paid service jobs, a lot of contingent part-time contract jobs, But high-paying, decent jobs, manufacturing, construction, not there. Oh, there's some pockets, tech jobs and so forth, but those are pockets within a otherwise economy that has a trouble creating quality jobs with wages. Right? Oh, they say, oh, wages are rising. Oh, yeah, but, that includes the high-end professionals, managers, salaries, and so on and so forth. They average it out. Don't believe any average wage indicators because they're all boosted by top-end increases. But you go to the median and below, there's no real wage gains. In fact, real wages are still declining, right? And will decline even more in 2016. Well, how do we get all this spending going on still to the extent it is, buying autos? Well, it's debt. It's all debt-based. It's not real income-based recovery for the majority. It's all debt-based stimulus going on, consumption. And that can't go on forever. It's all part of this very, very sick, weak U.S. Economy. When you look below the surface here, the key sectors, it does not look good. Export, manufacturing, construction flat. Wages really still not growing for most. Right? Service jobs being created, low pay, contingent, sharing economy, gig jobs, and so forth. This is not a basis for a sustained economic recovery. Right? And right into this, they're raising interest rates. Short term rates. Okay, it's only 0.25%, but they're talking about 3 more 0.25% raises here over the next year. That will bring the economy to a halt. By the way, on that question, it'll be interesting to see what happens to the U.S. economy in the first quarter of next year, January, March, 2016. The U.S. economy has come to a halt 4 times in the last 5 years during the winter quarter. GDP has collapsed to near zero or negative 4 years in a row. I'm going to predict here that we're going to see another, in the first half of the coming year, we're going to see another relapse. I call these relapse, single quarter collapses to near zero or negative. That happened in 2011, 12, 13, 14, always in the winter quarter. And that has, I think, a lot to do with business overproducing inventories, and then they don't really get sold off, so they really contract. Overlaid on that, the slowing of exports and manufacturing in the winter quarter. And that has a lot to do. Either that or there's something wrong with their statistics, which could be the case, because we've seen consistently here winter quarter GDP collapses, and then an artificial excess boost of U.S. GDP in the summer. It could be that there's a statistical problem here, and you smooth it all out, excess in the summer, excess decline in the winter, and you get this tepid, below historic average 1.7-1.8% GDP real growth when you back out the redefinitions. Okay, so that's the round robin of what's going on, and I took a little longer in talking about events than getting to the second version of what would be systemic fragility in global economy on my book. which was supposed to look at how economists get it wrong. That's part of the book. The three chapters are economists are screwed up. Can't forecast what's going on. We'll cover the theoretical errors of contemporary economics here when we follow up with the next show. So stay with us. Find out why economists are always wrong and they're getting the current economy wrong again. And our next show, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.